So much I wanted to get to. So behind us now, we're hearing six of the things I wanted to get to but didn't. Music from Three Leaves, Daylinale, Isomer, Belong, Cellar, and FAR. All behind us now. I hope you enjoy the program. Some of the things that I've loved most this calendar year 2011. This being the last radio program for me of this year. See you in the new year. Let me quickly tell you what we heard. John Mouse from his We Must Become the Pitiless Censors of Ourselves, Hey Moons, the track. Rangers before that. The CD is called Pan Am Stories, a track called Zombies Day. Hank Williams and Anita Carter on TV. I Can't Help It, I'm Still in Love with You. Haunted House, Blue Ghost Blues, the name of the CD. Millie's Not Afraid, the track we heard. Jealousy before that, performing live on Kaylee's Beast in the Airwaves program in October. Drug Souls. Terrors before that, from Lagan Cord, a great version of God Bless the Child. Linda Bruner with her beautiful version of Wichita Lineman from Songs for a Friend. Chris Forsyth with the Paranoid Cat Band from the Paranoid Cat LP. We heard Paranoid Cat Part 3. And we opened that set with a great song from Spiritual Rags, self-titled LP. I tried to stand up, but I could not stand. Thanks for listening. My name's Scott. I'll see you next week, next year. Stay tuned for Too Much Information with Ben Walker. This is Freeform Radio, WFMU in East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, worldwide, WFMU.org.
Yeah. Let me start by quoting from a review of this novel, Atlas Shrugged, that appeared in Newsweek. It said that you are out to destroy almost every edifice in the contemporary American way of life, our Judeo-Christian religion, our modified government-regulated capitalism, our rule by the majority will. Are these accurate criticisms?
Yes. I'm challenging the moral code of altruism, the precept that man's moral duty is to live for others. I am primarily the creator of a new code of morality, which has so far been believed impossible, namely, a morality not based on arbitrary edict, mystical or social. I hold that if man wants to live on earth, his highest moral purpose is the achievement of his own happiness, and that he must not force other people, nor accept their right to force him. That each man must live as an end in himself and follow his own rational self-interest.
May I interrupt now?
You may.
My name is Mab. I have a blog whose name is La Vérité Réelle et Certaine.
Mab is a Parisian blogger who writes about power, love, and the relationship between the sexes, all from a French perspective.
Maybe the French seduction is kind of special, that it's kind of insistent sometimes, and it's I don't know how is it exactly in the United States, you know better than me, but maybe, yes, when you say no to a man, you need to say no like 4 or 5 times. He doesn't realize it at the first time. Maybe the French men are a little bit slow. So in France, in my country, French feminists say that it was enough. For several years now, there is a new feminist movement in France called La Barbe, which means beard. And it's a new movement, very interesting, because they decide to act differently as the other feminist group. And so they decided to dress up like men. And you know that the beard is the most viril element, so they decided to wear some beard.
On her blog, The Certain Real Truth, MAB tries to keep abreast of La Barbe. She's been on the scene for most of the major actions, the storming of the French Parliament, the protest at the Bastille. She was even there for that riot that took place at the Louvre.
They were protesting, you know, against the fact that too many male painters are represented in this museum. And suddenly, just next to the pyramid outside the Louvre, a fight began between many beards. Everyone was punching each other, and the cup had to separate them. And one of the offshoots in the group was much more aggressive, and I decided to follow them. And they went to the terrace of a cafe, like, nearby. And I just, you know, sat next to them, writing notes. I heard some really frightening things. And they are really determined, and they wanted to do some special actions. They wanted to burn down the Louvre and all this institution dominated by the male. I could hear their conversation, and I understood that they are part of a new group named La Barbe Rouge, so the Red Beard. So I was at this terrace, and they were speaking together. And at the end, I presented myself to one of them, saying that I'm writing for a blog, and that I would like to write about them. And I gave them my card just in case. So after that meeting, I started to get regular emails updates from them, saying that they were preparing something big to take down a very famous French politician, very high-level French politician. And then, in the middle of May, I got this really short email saying, "Be prepared, we are in New York." And then, the FRDSK. But I never heard another word. Nothing from the Red Beard. Finally, about 5 days later, I received an email from someone belonging to the Barbe Rouge, to the Red Beard, saying, "Meet me at this cafe." Okay, so I met her at the cafe, and she looks very nervous and upset. And she began to tell me the story. She began to tell that she was the only one that didn't go to New York, that five of them went to New York to set up the SK.
This is what we keep hearing, that all French people think this was a conspiracy. Are you saying there really was a conspiracy?
According to this woman, yes. They knew that DSK will ask for a prostitute. So they decided to be in the hotel. They were disguised with their beard. And they decided at last, when he was asking for a prostitute, they grabbed the prostitute and they exchanged the prostitute with a maid.
So this woman that you're meeting at the cafe told you that they did it?
We don't know. That was the plan. But after that, we didn't have any news from the five Barbe Rouge that went to New York.
So why is this woman contacting you?
Because she was so frightened of what happened to her colleagues. And she knew that I was following the case. You know, the name of my blog shows how serious I am. And so she decided to tell me her theory. She thinks that behind all this story, there is the Barbe Bleue.
Bluebeard?
Yes. The rumor is that the Barbe Bleue is more an infiltration of La Barbe. And the rumor says that this infiltration is really connected to the extreme far-right party, the Front National of Marine Le Pen. So you may know that Marine Le Pen is a candidate for our next presidential elections. Maybe you don't know her in the USA, but she is the daughter of the historical leader of this party, Jean-Marie Le Pen. Her main argument is that the politicians are all corrupted, and actually she was the first in the media to tell that everyone know how DSK is in reality, and that no one had the courage to say the truth, and that for her it was not a surprise that he acted like that with a maid. And now the Marine Le Pen party is trying to find out every case of sex harassment to show how corrupted and how rotten is the parties, the French parties.
And what is her connection to Bluebeard?
So, that was the thesis of my contact. This woman with whom I was sitting in the cafe from the Red Beard, she was telling me that when she watched Marine Le Pen on TV, she was wearing a blue scarf, exactly like the one that one of the women who went to New York liked to wear.
The affair DSK was the topic of conversation, both when I left New York City and when I arrived in Paris. The only thing that changed was the number of conspiracy theories. In New York, pretty much everyone was convinced that Dominique Strauss-Kahn was guilty of molesting the chambermaid in his room at the Sofitel. Only one of my friends, Tom, was convinced otherwise. Tom believed that DSK was brought down by a cabal of bankers who feared his IMF socialist monetary policies. The night before I left, Tom sketched it all out for me on a cocktail napkin. It was an octopus with 1,000 tentacles. I recognized some of the names from the Elliott Spitzer case, the 2006 Kentucky Derby, and the 2008 financial meltdown. In Paris, everyone had a conspiracy theory. Some, like Tom, cited a Wall Street cabal, others President Sarkozy, and others the Greeks. Even France's intellectual elite waded into the cesspool. The philosopher Bernard-Henri Lévy wrote an editorial in which he stated it was unheard of for a chambermaid to enter a guest room at the Sofitel alone and unarmed. Now, if you are even a casual listener of this program, you're aware, of course, that I am easily seduced by conspiracy theories, which is why when I find myself getting too excited by one in particular, I try to find another, equally plausible, but yet contradictory. Thus, I was very pleased with myself when I came upon MAB and her theory. But last Sunday night, still suffering from jet lag, I wander down to the bar of my hotel, and I find myself drinking with a bunch of international hedge fund advisors in Paris for a retreat. And after they bombard me with conspiracy theory after conspiracy theory, I blow my top. Isn't it a bit disingenuous for you people to profess belief in conspiracy theories, I shout? I mean, aren't you the very people pulling the levers of global finance? You have no right to sit here and talk about shadowy forces secretly driving the global economy, because every time the have-nots do this, you poo-poo them with your Adam Smith and Ayn Rand. Like I said, I was a bit jet-lagged, and I was also kind of drunk, but even though I'm mixing my metaphors and continents and economic principles, I assure you, I'm certain of my convictions. But not a single one of these French bankers even knows who Ayn Rand is. I try to explain. I tell them how her book, Atlas Shrugged, is almost as popular as the Bible, and how thanks to her protege, Alan Greenspan, her economic ideas have come to define American policy. I try to explain her idea of unfettered human selfishness and how she believed it was the only true solution to society's problems. I even tell them about how, when I was 19 years old, I dated this girl who refused to have sex with me until I read Atlas Shrugged. But it seems like nothing I say makes any sense. So eventually, I flee the bar and take the elevator back to my hotel room. The next morning when I enter the dining room, that same group of international bankers greets me with a round of applause. You see, that very morning, there's an article in Le Monde all about Ayn Rand, explaining her role in American politics and economic theory. And for some reason, this article turns me, at least in their eyes, into a soothsayer, a prophet. I start to say that this is what is known as a coincidence, but then the beautiful dark-haired woman who the night before had wanted nothing to do with me grabs my hand, and so I hold my tongue, down a glass of orange juice, and return her deep, meaningful gaze. Of course, the global financial meltdown raises a number of questions about just who is pulling the levers of international finance. But to tell you the truth, the only question I want the answer to is this one. How the hell did America end up with the Tea Party and Iceland the best party? Iceland was one of the first countries to collapse from the greed and stupidity of the global financial elite. And in the aftermath, the comedian and actor John Gnarr, along with a number of artists and musicians, launched the Best Party. At first, everyone took them for clowns. One of Gnarr's campaign promises was a polar bear for the Reykjavik Zoo. But the Best Party was able to connect with the anger and frustration of the populace, and in 2008, John Gnarr became the mayor of Reykjavik. The Best Party also took a few seats on the city council. And since coming to power, they've taken on not only the financial sector, but the corrupt power industry and the redundancies of Iceland's education system. One of the reasons I accepted my invitation to moderate a panel at the International Forum on the Novel in Lyon was because I knew that John Gnarr would be there. I am extremely nervous about meeting him, because even though I've read numerous articles and reports about his past and his campaign, I'm still uncertain how serious he is now. I mean, now that he's the mayor, maybe he doesn't want to talk about surrealist comedy anymore. But during his presentation, he explains that not only has the Best Party not turned into a real political party after the election, it is precisely because the Best Party has remained true to its surrealist anarchist principles that it is succeeding in bringing about real change. The only way to combat nonsense, John Gnarr says, is with nonsense. After his presentation, a group of us go to dinner. I sit down next to him and his associate, Haida. It is a rapid-fire exchange of ideas and philosophies. It turns out we share many of the same interests in music, literature, cinema, comedy. He even agrees to record with me for the radio show after dinner. But then he brings up his favorite documentarian, Adam Curtis. When I tell him I've never watched any of Curtis's films, John Gnarr's brow furrows. "Really?" he says grimly. "Not even his documentary about George Bush and Al-Qaeda? The Power of Nightmares?" I freeze up. "It's on my list," I stammer. He turns to his associate Haida and starts speaking in Icelandic. Another thing John Gnarr is famous for is that he refuses to work with anyone who hasn't watched his favorite TV show, The Wire. And while I'm smart enough not to tell him about how much I don't like that show, it seemed like perhaps I'd blown it with my ignorance of Adam Curtis. Sure enough, Haida asks me if it'd be okay if we record in the morning instead of after dinner. "Of course," I say. and we make plans to meet in the lobby in the morning, and then we call it a night. When I get back to my room, I Google Adam Curtis. He has a brand new documentary called All Watched Over by Machines of Loving Grace. But when I check to find out when it's going to air, my eyes pop out of my head. It's just aired, like a few hours earlier. In fact, while we were having dinner. I log onto a BBC torrent site. It's already available, and so I download it. Now, while I'm usually able to keep myself from losing my head to conspiracy theories, serendipity is another matter entirely. Serendipity and coincidence are the invisible forces that seem to determine everything I do. And sometimes a coincidence can announce itself with such force, my entire worldview will change. Or at least the radio show that I'm working on. For example, the Adam Curtis documentary that I'm watching, thanks to my meeting with the mayor of Reykjavik, well, it's about the rise of computers and how they've fooled us into thinking that we can stabilize and manage systems like nature and the economy. But this documentary also focuses on the legacy of Ayn Rand. Adam Curtis's thesis is that she not only influenced Alan Greenspan, but the early pioneers of Silicon Valley as well. Now, let me tell you about the basic outline I had for this particular episode of Too Much Information. I came up with it on my flight to Paris. It was going to be a program about conspiracy theories and the market. I was going to start off with a segment about DSK, but I also had an idea for a segment about the Atlas Shrugged movie that came out last month, which totally bombed. I wanted to record some of the diehard Ayn Randians who've gone online to protest what they claim is a liberal Hollywood conspiracy denying the film the audience and glory it deserves. I had an Alan Greenspan tie-in planned as well. But the highlight of the episode was going to be a conversation with John Knarr. He would lay out just how different things are in Iceland and how much can be done when you fight nonsense with nonsense. And this would throw a harsh light on our situation where a single Wall Street executive has yet to be even charged with a crime. As you can imagine, this documentary pretty much fried my brain. There were just too many serendipitous connections and coincidences. Plus, it was way better than anything I've ever been able to make. In fact, this documentary makes me feel like such a rank amateur. For a moment, I contemplate tossing my laptop out the hotel window. My only consolation is that at least I'll get to record with John Knarr in the morning. When I wake up, there's a message for me at the front desk. The Icelanders have all left. A volcano had erupted in the middle of the night, and they had to get back before international airspace was closed. It's not like I'm unaccustomed to rejection. Trust me, this has been the year of rejection. But now, the universe was involved, so it really stung. Plus, I now had no show. And since I was spending the weekend at a castle in Burgundy, I had less than 24 hours to find a story that had something to do with Wall Street and conspiracy theory, or the whole thing would be a washout. Yes, it was kind of a gamble. But I don't want you to get the idea that I leave everything up to chance. Before I left, I recorded a segment with Justin Blum, a Bloomberg journalist who recently wrote a piece about Wall Street and the issue of indictments. For him, the story begins with a speech Attorney General Eric Holder made about a year and a half ago, in which he promised that the individuals responsible for the financial crisis would all be brought to justice.
Well, 18 months later, no senior Wall Street executive has been criminally charged, and that's left some lawmakers in the U.S. questioning whether the Justice Department has been aggressive enough in pursuing these kinds of cases. Now, that said, the Justice Department is quick to point out that it's prosecuted lots of Ponzi schemes, lots of financial crimes, lots of people who may have in some way profited from the financial crisis. They also point out that they prosecuted a number of mortgage fraud cases. Again, those are linked in many ways, in many cases, to the crisis, but they are not at the root cause of it.
Yeah, but what's the big holdup? I mean, the country fell apart. I don't want to sound flip, but when you have a company like Goldman Sachs betting against its own products, it seems that a case for fraud just can't be that difficult to mount.
To prosecute fraud criminally, the government generally has to show that executives knowingly made false statements or omitted the truth about a company's financial health. Bankers have argued that they broke no laws and can't be blamed for an industry-wide breakdown in risk controls. The Justice Department tried unsuccessfully to prosecute in 2009 two Bear Stearns hedge fund managers accused of misleading investors about the health of their funds. And that case may suggest that these types of prosecutions can be somewhat difficult to prove. In that case, prosecutors used emails as evidence and alleged that the managers touted their funds while privately saying they were financially unsound. And jurors acquitted these fund managers and said in subsequent interviews that the emails were inconclusive.
In your article, though, you do note that there has been some success with civil cases.
Well, while prosecutors have struggled to bring the criminal cases, there have been civil actions brought by the Justice Department and SEC. These civil actions require a lower standard of proof than the criminal cases would. So the Justice Department last month filed a civil suit for more than $1 billion against Deutsche Bank for allegedly lying repeatedly to qualify risky mortgages for government insurance program. As of April, the SEC said it had brought cases against more than two dozen senior corporate officers for misconduct related to the financial crisis. There have also been other cases where the SEC has brought civil actions against companies like Goldman Sachs, where Goldman Sachs paid $550 million to settle SEC claims it misled investors in collateralized debt obligations linked to subprime mortgages. But again, with those civil cases, it's a different standard of proof than it would be in a criminal case.
But for the millions of Americans who are still suffering from the financial meltdown, this idea of different standards seems more about influence than proof. I mean, Wall Street got a bailout and they're doing great. And so it seems that the different scenarios will in the end continue to beg the question as to why the hell no one's been charged. No?
The questions have definitely continued to dog the Attorney General Eric Holder along with the FBI director when they appear before Congress at hearings, standard oversight hearings. Lawmakers routinely now ask Attorney General Holder questions about why there haven't been more of these prosecutions. At a hearing in May, Zoe Lofgren, a California Democrat, questioned Holder on this issue, and she said the Justice Department is spending its resources prosecuting nannies and busboys who are trying to get back to their families on immigration violations. And she says, and yet we have not brought any prosecutions on the, as she calls it, bandits on Wall Street who brought the nation and the world to the brink of a financial disaster.
Well, you do point out that the Justice Department did get one big baddie, Sadistic Sadie.
That's right. So I looked at all of the cases of corporate fraud that the Justice Department brought last fiscal year. These are cases where the Justice Department classifies the cases in this way as corporate fraud versus something else. And most of the cases, the vast majority of the corporate fraud cases, involve people who were accused of ripping off companies as opposed to companies ripping off investors or others. And The cases included one of a roller derby team president in Ohio. She skated under the name Sadistic Sadie and was accused by the Justice Department of manipulating the ticketing system of her employer, United Airlines, to slash the cost of travel for her friends, family members, teammates. So there were a number of other sort of small-time cases, including one involving in Maryland involving a man who embezzled from his company. In New Jersey, there was a case involving a spa owner who was prosecuted for a scheme to avoid paying taxes. Now, in response to this, the Justice Department says, well, hold on, we prosecuted a number of fraud cases, Ponzi scheme cases and others that just may not have been classified as corporate fraud. They may have been classified as other in other categories. So I took a look at several different categories, securities fraud, corporate fraud, bank fraud and embezzlement, and mortgage fraud to get a sense of how many prosecutions there had been in recent years compared to earlier years. And so what I found is that for corporate securities and bank fraud, those prosecutions, the number of individuals prosecuted declined last fiscal year by 39% from 2003, which was the period after the accounting scandals at Enron and WorldCom.
So are we ever going to see a Wall Street executive get prosecuted?
The issue is this. For people who don't have access to all the evidence that the Justice Department does, it's hard to know exactly what happened. It's hard to know if, in fact, there were definitely crimes committed that the Justice Department is failing to prosecute, or that there were actions taken by executives on Wall Street that fall short of crimes that led to the crisis. So I think it's too soon to say. We'll just have to wait and see. Based on what the Attorney General has said, it's entirely possible there could be prosecutions, but it's really going to come down to whether ultimately the Justice Department concludes there's enough evidence to move forward and convince the jury beyond a reasonable doubt of that a crime was committed.
Now, indictments might not happen anytime soon, but there are a few Wall Street folks under investigation. One of these is the Goldman Sachs employee, Fabrice Touré. Thanks to a few indiscreet emails, this French banker may end up holding the bag for the firm's entire mortgage debacle. But according to a front-page story that ran in this past Wednesday's New York Times, the case has gotten more complicated, because now the Times has gotten its hands on more emails that suggest the case involves many, many more Goldman Sachs employees, something Touré's lawyers have been arguing all along. But the most curious element of the story concerns just how the Times got a hold of these emails. They claim a New York City artist-filmmaker named Nancy Cohen gave them a laptop that she had found in the trash, and that this laptop contained streaming email files belonging to Fabrice Touré.
I thought it was completely serendipitous that something like this would come into my hands.
Nancy Cohen's the artist-filmmaker who turned over that computer to the New York Times. I convinced her to say a bit more about how she came into possession of the laptop and what she hoped the media would do with it.
It was thrown out in the basement of a friend's building, and he always looked for things down there. You know, I got a lot of things from the building. There was, a lot of people, at a certain time, people were throwing out lots of very nice things. And I'm a recycler. I've gotten T-shirts, really lovely designer T-shirts from a photographer who bought a lot of clothing just for the photo shoots, and some excellent wine glasses. It's stuff like that that my friend didn't want, but he thought I would. And he knew I needed a laptop because I didn't have a computer at all. This just came to me. But, these things happen in my life, so this is not that... it was striking and ironic because I know nothing about finance. That's the unusual part. The fact that I got this, I have dreams and things happen.
So how did you come to realize that there were files, streaming email files on the laptop, to use the New York Times lingo, belonging to a Goldman Sachs banker?
I was reading The Guardian, which I read because I used to live in London and I like it. And I saw a tiny article with a very small article, and the name, there was a name, and I thought to myself, that sounds familiar. Is it a restaurant I've been to? A composer? I couldn't place the name. And, you know, it was stuck in my head, and I forgot about it. And a week later, I go on my computer, and the name was still there. It would come up next to mine, and I realized something. I wasn't sure what I realized, but I realized something. And that's kind of how I discovered I was living partially with a French banker.
So once you figured out who this laptop belonged to, Mr. Fabrice Touré, what did you do next?
So then what happened? Sorry, I'm also online. I shouldn't do that. I went in. I looked to see if I asked anybody if they knew anything about this person, or if they heard anything about this. And unfortunately, most of my friends were not very hip to the Goldman Sachs story. You know, they're mostly artists. They don't think about it. And I went on the internet and I tried to look up stuff and I found out things about him. So then I tried to look in my computer, thinking, well, this was your computer. I mean, there probably couldn't be anything on here. You're a whiz kid. You don't throw out a computer with anything on except that your name was still there. And in fact, there were some things on there. And I'll leave it at that.
But why did you decide to turn it over to the New York Times? I mean, what were you hoping for? Justice? Accountability?
This wasn't easy to do. This was a very painful year where this took preeminence in a lot of my thoughts and actions. And I was nervous most of the time, extremely nervous, because I felt that I had to do something, and I'm not in a very powerful position in the world. I'm an artist. I want to communicate ideas, and I wanted to spend my time doing that, finishing a film, writing songs, blah, 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 not doing this. But I felt that it was important enough for me to, at the end of the day, trot over to the New York Times and hope that they would be able to bring to light whatever was in this, whatever material was in here could be deciphered by them and be analyzed by them and could help, you know, throw some light on a very dismal financial situation and perhaps even relieve this kid, Fabrice Touré, of some of the pressure he's been living under, because it seemed to me that he may have been scapegoated, and that, you know, it didn't seem right. It didn't seem right that it would all be blamed on one person, because it's never one person. It's more an institution, an institutional way of thinking, and an idea that, you know, money is everything. And it's not just a financial issue, it's a spiritual issue. People are losing their sense of hope and belief, and, you know, their lives are being diminished. And the way that greed has taken hold of the consciousness, greed and stupidity, it's more an idea than someone being held accountable. I think the ideas have to change. The whole way we think has to change, you know. You know, I didn't get any money for this from the New York Times, but this was an effort because I really believe in change, and I believe we deserve to have change in our lives. And I felt that this may have something in it that could change, and I didn't know. I had no idea for sure, but I don't really care about punishment. That's not interesting to me. I just wanted to see. I suppose, you know, it was the way I felt when I saw Plunder, or what's the other film? The one by Charles Ferguson. I mean, Inside Job, you know, I didn't understand any of this world. I knew that things had gone awry, but I didn't understand how it affected me. I didn't go to Wharton Business School. I don't read the Wall Street Journal. I just know that every day a little shop that I love closes and quality of life shuts down. And I think that the general population, and we're not the most educated country in the world for sure, and you know, we only have one major newspaper in this big city. I wanted the information to somehow get to people. I wanted people to be more informed so that, you know, we can look at unfettered capitalism and think about revising it. I don't know. I'm not a politician, nor am I a sociologist. I just am a dreamer. And, you know, we just dream for a better world.
was in my early 20s, and my brother gave me my first copy of The Fountainhead. Reading the book just awakened something in me.
Susan Mule is a typical Ayn Rand fan in that she can recall the exact moment she discovered the work of the objectivist philosopher and novelist. Also typical is this claim that The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged were life-changing reads.
At the time, I was trapped in a very unhappy marriage and didn't feel like I had the personal power to do anything about it. Reading The Fountainhead and then Atlas Shrugged and Anthem and We the Living, all of her books, awakened something in me. And I realized at that point that I had this power in me to make my own choices, to live my own life, and was able to leave that situation and go on to have a much more fulfilling life. I went back to school. I got a teaching degree. I married a wonderful man, had a wonderful daughter. And I really feel that I owe much of this to whatever was awakened me in me the first time I read those books.
Well, obviously for you then, when you learned that Atlas Shrugged was finally getting turned into a movie, this must have been pretty exciting.
I was excited. I wasn't entirely sure until I was sitting in the theater that it was actually going to happen. My husband, my daughter, and I and her friend went to see the show the day that it came out. We bought our tickets the day that they came out, about 2 weeks before we actually went to the movie.
And what'd you think?
I was very happy with it.
The critics don't seem to share your view, do they?
I think it's been an averaging about one star out of a 4-star rating by critics. By contrast, it's been averaging 3-4 stars from the viewers.
So a lot of the fans who are active online like yourself, Susan, seem to be making the case that the critical dismissal of this movie is a liberal Hollywood conspiracy. What do you make of this?
I don't want it to be true, but I think that it is. The things that they're saying about the movie are just very surprising. There's been a lot of comment about the fact that it was low budget. And in Atlas Shrugged, I did not see the kinds of film mistakes that I saw, for example, in Twilight. One of the vampires had their makeup literally coming off. You know, those were the kinds of things that they didn't go back and refilm. Yet no one talked about that in any of the reviews. So I think that is one of the things that a lot of us are frustrated about, is the kinds of things that are being said that simply do not seem to be the case.
We drove 3 hours each way to see the premiere the first day at the first showing, and my hands were trembling all the way. The one thought in my mind was, please don't suck. Please don't suck.
Michael Brown is another Ayn Rand devotee who's also been waiting years for Atlas Shrugged to make it to the big screen. He told me there was a lot at stake.
Everybody knows the controversy about Rand. You know, there are people who think she's the greatest thing since sliced bread, and some people think she's the worst thing since Hitler. You know, so that we know, you know, going in, there's going to be controversy. But for me personally, as the movie went on and I saw it, they'd actually kind of magically, in my view, managed to penetrate to the essence of the book. I was transported. It was almost like a trance state. And I'm not trying to be exaggerated there. I really mean it.
So I take it you liked it.
It's exhilarating. I find the movie an exhilarating experience. We've seen it close to 10 times.
So what do you make of this idea that many fans of the movie are expressing online, that there is a conspiracy to deny this movie the audience and the glory that it deserves?
There's a conflict between the vision of Atlas Shrugged and the current present-day vision of, I would say, most people in the United States in one way or the other. And this is a very challenging book. And the movie is challenging also. It's an indie production. It's not made with, you know, $100 million or anything like that. And the style of filmmaking, it matches the book in some important ways. So I can't say that there's any kind of conspiracy. There doesn't need to be. I mean, most of the critics are probably of particular aesthetic schools that Atlas Shrugged goes up against. And we have to bear in mind that the film was promoted very much on an indie basis. In my opinion, a little under-promoted. They try to promote it via social media, and I think the thought was that it would sort of promote itself. So since the movie didn't promote itself, I'm kind of stepping up. I mean, I've organized a Support the Atlas Shrugged movie Facebook group, and I kind of post incessantly. It's probably how you found me. And I want to see this. I want to see this movie succeed. I want to see the DVD come out. I want to see it go internationally. There are people in India who are dying to see the movie. I've got, you know, there are hundreds of Indian fans of the book alone out there who are dying to see this thing.
This is something that admirers of Rand have been waiting for 40 years.
Lauren Siskind is another Ayn Rand superfan, but as he writes in his review for the American Thinker website, this mediocre mess is a tragic letdown, a cinematic disaster unworthy of Ayn Rand.
Well, there was just a growing sense of disappointment as the movie went along. When I saw the stock footage of the Rocky Mountains still on the screen when Dagny and Hank Reardon are driving through Wisconsin, then I realized this just doesn't have very high production values. This is a grade B production at best. This is not Tiffany's, this is costume jewelry.
So your piece, Who Botched John Galt, on the American Thinker website has a large number of comments, and most of them strongly disagree with your review. Some even fault you for adding fuel to the liberal Hollywood fire. What do you make of this argument that there's a conspiracy to keep this movie from the American people?
Oh, that's silly. Look, if you're going to make a movie out of one of the most titanic novels of the last century, you have to invest more than $8 to $10 million in it. If you're going to do it on the cheap, you're not going to come out with a good product. And if you believe that anyone who criticizes that result is part of a conspiracy against Rand, then you're actually being unfaithful to Rand's own philosophy, which is to recognize reality.
Can you tell me why that so many of the fans of Ayn Rand seemed to be having such a real difficulty separating, you know, criticism of this grade B movie from criticism of her ideas? What is it about her that inspires such a freaky cult-like devotion?
I'll tell you my story. I read Atlas Shrugged in ninth grade when I discovered I had a problem with my knee, which required me to sit in an easy chair with a heating pad for a couple of hours each day. And the doctor told me if I did that, I'd be okay, but I'd never be able to run. Well, I hadn't thought about running before he told me that. But after he told me that, and I used that time to read Atlas Shrugged, I got so determined that I went out for the track team and became captain of the track team. Now, I'm not saying that reading the novel makes you leap tall buildings in a single bound, but it does give you a sense that achievement is important, that you should try to live for your ambitions, and that accomplishment is a noble goal.
I don't believe there's a conspiracy. The film business is a business, and they will make it whatever movie you'll pay for. Part of the problem is that people will not go and pay for movies they say they won't make.
Gene Oliver is a businessman and a theater owner. Recently, he posted a message to a Texas GOP website reminding Ayn Rand's fans that if they want to see movies like Atlas Shrugged, including the proposed Atlas Shrugged Part 2 and Atlas Shrugged Part 3, it's their duty to support these movies with ticket sales. Echoing Lauren Siskind, he reminds all good Randians that the only possible invisible force determining what they can and can't see at the movie theater is, of course, the market.
The voting booth is a ticket box.
Thank you. I know that the economy right now is bad, and you know, jobs are down and everybody's worried about it. It's obviously an issue, but I would say for those that are looking for work, one sector of the economy that is definitely still doing very well is security.
Yeah, but you know, most folks don't have access to, you know, the gravy train that is, you know, the Homeland Security private industrial complex.
Right, but I'm not talking military industrial complex. I'm talking about, you know, rent-a-cops. In fact, a buddy of mine owns a private security company, and they just got this huge contract with, believe it or not, with Alan Greenspan.
Why does Alan Greenspan need rent-a-cops?
Well, apparently, he is very worried that he's going to get DSK'd.
Does Alan Greenspan have, like, a lady problem?
Well, yeah, you wouldn't think so because he's Alan Greenspan, but at the same time, he's Alan Greenspan.
So he's worried he's going to get set up?
Yeah, honeypotted is the term.
Okay, well, fine. You have a couple bodyguards. Problem solved. I mean, I would imagine he's had bodyguards from the beginning. I mean, why does he need to hire, you know, freak out and get a whole security service?
Well, yes, but that was before L'Affaire DSK, right? Now, you can't just keep the women away from the guy. You got to keep them away from all of his property.
What do you mean?
Well, I don't know. Woman get into his house, his library, his car. I mean, you find her DNA in the backseat of the car or on the stick shift. You can't have that happen. I mean, because the next step is you're doing the perp walk on national TV. And so that's why this turns into a big deal, because Greenspan owns a lot of property.
Really?
Yeah. During the housing boom, he just went apish. I mean, he bought everything. He bought apartments, condos, houses, a lot of commercial real estate, huge office skyscrapers. I mean, he had his fingers in everything. I mean, I've seen the list. It is mind-blowing.
Why have you seen the list?
Well, my buddy really wanted this contract for his company, but he didn't have enough people. He had to call in a lot of favors. And since I happen to be in between gigs right now, and the pay is really good, I said, sure, why not? And in fact, that's where I am right now. I am chilling out, keeping an eye on a small office in a half-finished strip mall out here in Centerville, Virginia.
So you are basically getting paid to watch over one of Alan Greenspan's toxic assets because the man is scared he's going to get honeypotted.
Yeah, it sounds silly when you put it like that, and maybe it is, but I think that I'm actually keeping an eye on what appears to me to be an important component of Alan Greenspan's portfolio.
Really?
Yes, back in the 1950s, Alan Greenspan met Ayn Rand, who would become a major force and sort of idol in his life.
I think I'm aware of that.
Uh-huh. Well, some people definitely make the case that his friendship and admiration for Rand influenced his, you know, sort of policy and philosophy, but I don't know about that, but I can definitely tell you that it has influenced his collecting activities.
What do you mean?
Dude, this office is basically an Ayn Rand shrine. It seems like Alan Greenspan went out and found and purchased every Ayn Rand-related object that he could find. and they're all here. This place is just packed with books and statues and posters, tchotchkes and lamps and wine openers and dishware and beach towels and Ayn Rand mud flaps. But the weirdest thing I found is this thing called the invisible hand. And it's, at least according to the box, a exact silicone replica of Ayn Rand's right hand.
So I'm confused. Is this just like a cardboard box, something he had made, you know, with his handwriting on it?
No, this actually is, it looks manufactured. It looks like something you would find on a rack in a porn store. And I think it's been used.
This episode of Too Much Information is called The Invisible Hand. It was produced by myself, Benjamin Walker, with Bill Bowen. It featured MAB, Justin Blum, Nancy Cohen, Michael Brown, Susan Mule, Lauren Siskind, and TMI's special correspondent, Chris. On the TMI show page, you'll find links and images, and that's where you can subscribe to the TMI podcast. All that at WFMU.org.
And you're listening to WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, WFMU.org. Nardwar is next.
Three.
Nardwar! 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 Nardwar!
And you're listening to WFMU. And it's time right now for the Nardwar, the Human Serviette Radio Show. Today on the Nardwar to Human Serviette radio show, two interviews with Henry Rollins. One interview from 1998 and another interview from 2011. Henry Rollins times two. Today on the Nardwar the Human Serviette radio show on WFMU. First off, who are you?
My name is Henry Rollins.
Henry, I think I know you.
Oh, I see. You're a character now.
No, I'm not a character. Actually, I ran into you in Los Angeles outside of the Guitar Center. I think you were returning a frame. You were in a Carmagia with a beautiful woman, and I saw you going to a frame shop on Sunset. Do you remember that at all?
Was that the one where I punched the windshield out?
No, you didn't punch the windshield, but you did jam on the dashboard.
Yeah.
Did you remember seeing me, or is that this? Does that happen a lot of times?
No, that was the incident where... I punched the windshield because this person kept staring at me and I got frustrated. And I actually broke that windshield and had to pay for it and drop another one in. That was my friend Peggy. Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry if I caused that to happen, but I was just like looking through the corner of the window.
Yes, I know.
I just was not. I was at Guitar Center and I did not expect to see. What were you getting framed there, Henry?
I forget.
It was a picture or something?
Yeah.
So what are you doing here? Like, I can see in Los Angeles, that's kind of like a freak show to meet you there in Los Angeles. But what are you doing here in Vancouver, in my town, Vancouver, BC, Canada?
I came here to meet you.
So, Henry, you're doing Welcome to Paradox. What is Welcome to Paradox all about?
Isn't this show called Betaville?
I think it's called Welcome to Paradox.
Okay. Well, they offered me a nice part in this one episode, and I looked at the script and liked it. And they said I could have the part, so I said, okay.
This particular episode is titled All Our Sins Forgotten?
Right.
And do you realize that Ron Reyes lives in Vancouver?
Yes.
You know, one of the original Black Flag singers like yourself, and he's a born-again Christian.
Well, we all end up something.
But I thought that's kind of neat. All sins forgotten and Ron Reyes, and you're in Vancouver, B.C.
You know, the way you can put it all together like that is just amazing, because I never would have been able to piece it together like that.
Well, Henry, also, you were in the movie Johnny Nuh.
Johnny Nuh.
Yeah. Johnny Mnemonic, written by William Gibson, a Canadian, who lives in Vancouver, B.C., Canada.
Right.
And in that movie, what did you play?
I played a scientist.
And what are you playing in this particular production?
Scientist.
And what have you played also? You've also played it's either a cop or a scientist, isn't it? A scientist or a doctor, a lot of the roles?
Cops and scientists and thugs.
And in Vancouver, B.C., there is Rollins Trucks. There's Rollins Trucks. Why did you name yourself Rollins? It wasn't for Rollins Trucks at all, was it, Henry?
Actually, it was. Rollins Trucks and Security Systems. Because I like mobility and I like security.
Why do you think people think that you hate Vancouver or Winnipeg? You know, people think that you hate Vancouver or Winnipeg.
Oh, because I used to very much. Because I would come here and you guys would be a shitty, spitting, heroin-shooting, equipment-stealing audience who we weren't allowed to kill. So after I got out of Black Flag and I didn't have to come here anymore, when I became the boss of the system, I stopped coming here so I didn't have to get spat on and have my equipment ripped off by idiotic punk rock junkies. So I gave the city about 7 years to cool off and came back and found it to be a very wonderful place.
So it's no longer Drunkville to you?
No.
Because some of the media was quite harsh on you. I noticed the Vancouver, I picked this from a zine from 1985, and it's called The Black Flag Scorecard. And it was like a little scorecard here where it says, it was like the audience versus Black Flag. Middle fingers for punks. Insults. Objects thrown. Mean faces. General ridicule. Like, they were kind of maybe Vancouver. Did this happen a lot? Like, the fanzines, you know, of the time kind of making fun of Black Flag gigs? Because I thought maybe this is what helped add to your Vancouver hatred.
I never read any of the fanzines, really.
So you never saw anything? There's no other Black Flag scorecards about then?
Wow, I never even seen that photo. You know why I had my wrist wrapped up like that?
No.
That's from punching a guy.
There's some little quotes you said from the stage. If I got a penny for each time you little boys beat off, I could, you know, I could buy this country. Is that one of your lines, do you think?
I don't know.
And Henry, Winnipeg, did you hate Winnipeg as well?
Yeah, because the promoter ripped us off and we actually had to go to his house to get paid, and also some of our equipment got ripped off, and at one point someone poured a beer into our soundboard, which we really
didn't have. Like a Madonna tape, like I heard somebody like stole your personal tape deck or sit on it and had like a Madonna tape.
I don't remember any of that.
So it was going to the promoter's house and people like trying to destroy the equipment. Have you been to Winnipeg back? Like, have they survived the 7-year ban, Henry Rollins?
I don't know, Nardwar. I can't remember. I'd have to look.
But
I think so.
Edmonton was pretty cool, wasn't it? Like, the two 7-Elevens across the street from each other? What can you say about that?
Well, I'll go anywhere where the people are cool. But if the crowd's going to be a drag, why should I return? You know, there's... And you know, those two Canadian cities were just a drag. I mean, the people were idiots. And you're just lucky no one was hurt worse. I mean, the promoter, McKeegan, he eventually got all four of his front teeth knocked out by another Canadian fellow who came to the aid of a band he was trying to rip off. So you had a fellow, forget his name, very good guy, young man who knocked the guy's teeth out.
It was cool, though, two 7-Elevens across the street. You wrote about that in Spin. I'll never forget.